for a while, it almost seemed before Christmas and in the early stages of this year, it almost was impossible to go out for a drink in Westminster and talk about the Conservative Party and the state of the economy without someone mentioning Philip Blond.
The people in this lively, diverse crowd in a central London hall this week have come in pursuit of a mystery. The man they've come to hear, Philip Blond, is a thinker from far away with a provocative label, the Red Tory, and he's causing quite a stir in the world of political ideas.
I've heard about the Red Tory concept. I don't know a lot about what it is, so I guess I'll find out more.
Basically, I've been searching for fresh ideas coming from the right.
So Philip Blond's a name you've noticed. Do you want to find out more?
Yes.
I don't strictly buy into the marketing slogan on Red Tory, but Philip Blond's an interesting guy.
I think the first thing I'd like to do is outline what's new. And in outlining what's new, I'd like to outline what's broken. And for me, in this order, the fundamental thing that's broken is a liberal settlement.
Blond opens his talk with a characteristically bold challenge to what he calls the broken liberal settlement, the obsolete political consensus of the last 30 years. James Crabtree from Prospect magazine, dedicated eavesdropper in the watering holes of the top policy wonks, sensed Blond's growing influence a few months ago.
In fact, it almost got to the point where there was a prize to be offered for the first person who mentioned him in any conversation because his name was becoming so ubiquitous. People wanted those who were thinking about how the Conservatives could become slightly left-wing, more left-wing, or could have a different view on the market. And there was absolutely nobody in that space apart from Philip. And that meant that he was not just the right person with some interesting ideas, but he certainly was the right person at the right time as well.
Most extraordinary is Philip Blond's emergence from what, to the policy professionals, is a mystifyingly unfamiliar background. Until recently a theology lecturer at the University of Cumbria, he remains happy to discuss the merits of medieval philosopher Thomas Aquinas, as well as the economic theory of quantitative easing. And the northern communities where he's grown up and lived have moulded one of his strongest political passions, the need to restore viable communities, as he described in a recent BBC interview.
We can see the rise of monopolies on our own high street. It's increasingly difficult for small businesses to open, to operate and make a return. So we have, in a sense, we have the creation of ghost towns or clone towns. Clone towns where all our high streets are the same, taken over by essentially the same transnationals. Ghost towns are where they can't make a return, and nor can ordinary small businesses, so nobody trades. So what I would like to do is have a radical rebalancing of the market to enable local businesses to develop and prosper and grow and spread ownership and wealth across the community. This time.
The Specials, who sang of ghost towns in the 1980s, were a favourite band for Blond, then a teenager in a family of five children on Merseyside. There, and later as a student in Hull, he watched northern cities struggling while economic health, civic pride and political power drained away. The time of the miners' strike, recalls his brother, Louis Blond, was especially troubling.
The miners' strike was huge. There was, you know, huge unemployment and people couldn't control the futures. And I think Phil was, I remember him coming home when I was still in sixth form, you know, with a miner's badge and bleached blonde hair. But we were actually involved in kind of demonstrations, protesting because the experience of being kind of a young in the 80s as a student and perhaps a middle class student, you were still supporting where you came from and northern people and northern jobs.
Philip Blond, the student, was intellectually restless, switching his studies from biology to politics and philosophy, also spending time in the United States. As a graduate at Cambridge University, he discovered his love of theology. His tutor there was John Milbank.
He was unmissable. He was noisy, boisterous, generally regarded as a Rottweiler, fizzing with ideas, both philosophical and political. I think he was still working out what big thing he should do in life, and this has only gradually emerged.
In his academic life, what emerged included a fascination with medieval theology. The man who'd been a boisterous Rottweiler of a student was also capable of almost monastic devotion to mastering not only theology, but also, say, economics, staying up late in his rooms in Cumbria once the day's teaching was done. all fed into what became a full frontal challenge to the secular liberal consensus that he and his allies saw as dominating British life. John Milbank.
It comes out of a certain kind of northern experience, allied, I think, to an extraordinary good grasp of economics, which is amazing coming from a complete amateur. It's almost as if Philip has, for the first time, demonstrated that to some extent, you know, the political emperors have no clothes, that actually academics sitting at their desk and thinking very hard can come up with more interesting problems and solutions.
It's been in the new David Cameron-led Conservative Party that Blond has shrewdly seen the best vehicle for his views. Calling himself Red Tory was a conscious attempt to force people to think differently. But it wasn't, like New Labour, primarily about novelty. Blond, the lover of history, says James Crabtree, wants to take the Tories back to what he sees as their nobler past.
Philip's argument is that there's a lost tradition of conservatism, that around about 1979, with Thatcherism, the Tories took a handbrake turn to the right and abandoned some rather rich elements of conservative thinking, some of which are rooted in religious thinking in medieval times, but more latterly in the 19th century, prime ministers like Benjamin Disraeli or thinkers like G.K. Chesterton or Hilaire Belloc had a religiously infused social conservatism, which was very local, which was often anti-big business, which was anti-state. And he felt that most of these ideas had been junked when the Conservatives had hitched their wagon to Thatcher and free market economics.
However plausible the theory, why would the fiercely competitive Westminster policy world listen to an outsider like Blond? It did indeed take some time for him to be noticed, and he's now in his mid-40s. But he is a formidable and persistent networker. Madeleine Bunting, a columnist for The Guardian newspaper, admired the way he attracted attention.
He's clearly a very good salesman for his ideas. He brings to that a kind of flamboyance, take me or leave me, a sort of bravado, which is very non-metropolitan. There's no sort of soft sell here. This is just right out street hawker style. And in some sense, that is about an outsider sort of who thinks, well, what have I got to lose? You know, I'm not already kind of plugged into this establishment. I'm not already compromised with kind of connections and relationships that I don't want to screw up. So here goes. And that's entertaining.
Being entertaining might not have been enough had it not been for the trauma of the economic crisis and the increasingly frenetic search for fresh ideas and moral revival. By early this year, Philip Blond left his academic post in Cumbria to become director of the new Progressive Conservatism project at the think tank Demos, with David Cameron, no less, attending its launch.
Can I say what a pleasure it is to share a platform with Philip, the so-called Red Tory. Of course, I brought you the Green Tories with Vote Blue, Go Green. I'm not pre-announcing our next election slogan, Vote Blue, Go Red.
The Conservative policy kaleidoscope was becoming a little hard to follow as Red, Blue and Green competed to challenge Brown's Britain. But Cameron was careful to avoid too close an association with Blond's philosophical assault on all current politics.
And I know that progressive conservatism, the idea that today conservative means are the best way to achieve progressive aims, although that will be the underlying philosophy of any government I lead, political leadership is not just about having a guiding philosophy. It's about putting that philosophy into practice.
While Blond may be more at home in philosophical debate, he has put forward some practical proposals. He wants the post office turned into a kind of people's bank, rooted in local communities, as an alternative to the globalised financial institutions that have let so many down. And some of his language has started appearing in David Cameron's rhetoric. For the traditional blue rinse brigade of the Tory party, increasingly visible blonde streaks in their leader's new style are alarming. Nor will some take kindly to Blond's forthright views on Margaret Thatcher's legacy.
If you look at the scale of inequalities that jumped under Mrs. Thatcher, they've been made virtually permanent under New Labour. One of the things I'm suggesting is Conservatives should take issues of equality more seriously. If you have very, very large levels of inequality, everybody suffers, including the wealthy. You have higher rates of mental affliction, higher rates of obesity, higher rates of teenage pregnancies, any social ill, greater number of people in prisons. Any social ill you care to name is proportionally related to higher degrees of inequality.
While such rejection of economic liberalism may make right-wing Tories splutter, Blond's views on social liberalism might make them cheer. He's condemned what he calls the licentious, pleasure-seeking drones of the 1960s and their legacy of divided families, unparented children, and the lazy moral relativism of the liberal professional elite. And he's fiercely critical, too, of what he sees as the failure of the welfare state to improve lives and communities.
The point I would argue is the state is not the vehicle to relieve people's impoverishment. The idea that we have inequality, therefore the state steps in, actually for me, and part of what I'm arguing, is the state is also an agent of disempowerment and an agent that increases inequality. It traps people in welfareism, it traps people in various forms of bureaucratic and social isolation that keeps them where they are.
That kind of view might be expected to alienate the Red Tory completely from the Labour Party. But Blond has his admirers there too. John Cruddas is an influential Labour backbencher.
If the Conservatives take on what Philip suggests, they will become a very, very powerful political force. I don't think they can, because I think they're too lashed to Thatcherism, especially amongst the younger generation of MPs in Westminster. So Cameron, even if he wanted to, would be unable to appropriate all of what Philip's suggesting.
Would you like more people in your own party to listen to Philip Blond?
Oh, definitely, definitely. He's painting in big primary colours about issues in a language of responsibility, relationships, fraternity, in a way that we've lost that language.
But some of Philip Blond's language on community worries Madeleine Bunting, as she wonders how his ideal communities, inspired by historical models, will be created in the circumstances of modern, multi-ethnic Britain.
Some of the things he said on community have frankly really alarmed me. I mean, at one occasion he said to me, community and individual, you know, they're one and the same thing. And then on another occasion he phrased it very differently. And when I've challenged him, he said, no, you know, I recognise the role of individual freedom and of course the community can be oppressive. Well, these are the territory that you've got to pick your way through quite carefully. And I don't think he's been, so far, careful enough. But I do think that actually people are really challenging him on this, and I think he will refine his thinking.
We have a legacy of ever more pervasive and ever more damaging individualism, and a legacy of ever more pervasive and ever more damaging state authoritarianism.
Whatever the criticism, Blond will continue to relish the debate. A book on the Red Tory ideal is due, plus one on the great medieval thinker Thomas Aquinas, to make sure the politicians don't forget their faith must be backed by reason. Blond is raising questions everyone wants answered, suggests Madeleine Bunting, even if his own views are not to everyone's taste.
He's very much sort of Marmite. People either love him or hate him. To his credit, he's rather charming. So even people that might radically disagree with his views, they can't help sort of quite liking him because he's terribly sort of very happy to sit down and discuss this. I'll discuss everything. I get the impression that Philip would sort of discuss it and discuss until, you know, the cows came home all night, all day. He's got a tremendous sort of appetite for all of this. But I think there's a lot of people who are thinking, you know, it's flash in the pan. I mean, who is this theology guy from Cumbria? You know, it won't be long before he's back in Cumbria, I think is the assumption of quite a lot of people. I'm not sure. I think that's a bit of an underestimation.
Some may wish Blond banished back to Cumbria, and he himself has to decide how far he wishes to be drawn into the compromises of policymaking rather than remaining a more independent but less influential intellectual. But his success in recent months reveals much about this vulnerable but exciting moment in our debate about the fundamentals of economics, society and morality. And whatever his long-term impact, a Red Tory has certainly made British politics more colourful.